Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the two-hour-long Zero Point radio show through BBS Radio. It is July 24th, 2010. My name's Christopher Holmes, and I'm a writer on mystical teachings and modern science, and the psychology of the heart, and the science of the soul. These are some of my primary interest areas, and I explore widely such esoteric teachings as Blavatsky, Secret Doctrine, the writings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and the Fourth Way teaching, as well as yogic teachings, Kabbalah, as well as such things as modern physics and other modern sciences. I work under the term Zero Point, which is taken from, the term is taken from the Secret Doctrine of Blavatsky in Book 1, and she explains that living beings have zero point centers, and that's called in a human being a Leia center. The term Leia means rest. So in the, Blavatsky explains that in creation science, cosmoses or living beings differentiate from a Leia center, a life center. So a zero point, the idea of a zero point is that a human being has a zero point center. And I explore this idea in terms of understanding modern quantum physics and how living beings have zero point centers. And we'll be exploring this idea today and drawing from the Secret Doctrine. My co-host is James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good. Jim, The lady who does the layouts for my books, she's most of the way through God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. So I've been back into that work more lately, looking at edits on it and such. And I thought that maybe we'd go back and pick up on doing that, like part two of the creation studies according to the Secret Doctrine.
Yeah, that would be very interesting, because we got away from that a bit. It was a very interesting presentation, I thought, which you started with. I just mentioned to you that, I don't know if I spoke to you about this, but I have finished, I read The Heart Doctrine twice this year, and it's a very interesting book in the sense that, it's a very interesting book, period. And to me, what's really striking to me is that, you know, I've read this book probably in one form or another, I don't know how many times, but at least 10 times over the years that you've written and rewritten it. It's taken on different manifestations and different forms and formats. But it's essentially the core of the book has been there for a good 15 years, and you've kept, refining it and in some ways adding to it, but the core of the book has been there. And it was really interesting this time when I read it. Like, there are parts about it, like the section on the problem of God's contracting universes, that material is very old, 25 to 30 years old, and I feel like I know that material so well because I worked with you on it, and I've written as my own version of it, and I, you know, it's kind of always been part of the general presentation that you make, but there were parts of the work, some of the material on Kabbalah, some of the work on Blavatsky's work that I really, it's funny, like I've read it and I know something about this, but I just sort of got it on a whole different level this time. It was very interesting to me that, and we mentioned this before, that this is the first time it's been formatted, the actual physical book is formatted, it's a trade paperback and a nice looking book, nice cover, and so it felt a little bit different reading it in that format, for sure. And it's a very, very, very impressive book, and people should go to www.zeropoint.com and learn a little bit more about it, or go to Amazon, because you can get it on Amazon, and check it out. It's I highly recommend it to anybody who's who's interested in Christopher's work or who's interested in anything to do with mysticism or with the nature of human consciousness and psychology, or who has an interest in contemporary physics. All of these topics are touched upon in ways and to depths that I don't think appear in anybody else's work that I know of, and I'm fairly knowledgeable about writings in these areas. It's a unique perspective. It's not something that you can grasp immediately. It's a radically different perspective from even that from that which appears in many books, which are sympathetic to esoteric and mystical studies of consciousness. I think you've really extrapolated things, Chris, that other people don't see, and I think you present them in a way that is quite unique. I would say that anybody who wants to be informed in these areas has to read this book and should read this book. I just read so many things from different sources, and so much of it is just what I would call just drivel. It's just nonsense. This is not to say that I think that your perspective is. We've been over this before too, but it's not that it's your perspective, it's your integration of these different perspectives from the esoteric and mystical tradition and your interpretation, which is so unique. If it was just you, I wouldn't feel as strongly as I do, but it's just such authority to all of this. I think in articulating the Heart Doctrine in particular, I certainly had read many esoteric sources and had been very interested in the study of consciousness from esoteric and mystical sources and perspectives, but I had never recognized this, and I don't know of anybody else who really has recognized the importance of the Heart Doctrine and has provided such a thorough analysis and such a convincing presentation of what that model would mean when contrasted with what you call the Head Doctrine in modern psychology in terms of understanding consciousness. This is a radically different perspective, but it's an eminently sensible, coherent, lucid, and comprehensive perspective, and I think it really addresses a lot of recognized and existent anomalies, enigmas, and mysteries that are attached to consciousness research. So, bravo! It's a wonderful book, and the book on Blavatsky is further that we're going to talk about today. Is a further extrapolation and an even more, in some ways, an even more daring presentation of the mystical esoteric perspective its meaning and import for modern thinking on the nature of consciousness and the nature of reality, essentially.
Wow, thank you for your valuable commentary and insights, Jim. It's a unique book in how it so focuses on this idea that there's a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart. And the idea that it within the heart is the bliss sheath or some essential I, like in modern science, they think that your sense of self is produced by your thinking and your cerebral cortex and your mind in your head. And they don't think a human being has an essential I within them. Whereas in all the mystical and spiritual teachings, your essential I and being self-existence or consciousness emerges from a kind of a point source related to the heart. So it's saying there's this whole higher dimensional physics to what the human heart is and what reality really is. As you say, it's like... it was funny, I watched a video the other day by Melchizedek, who wrote that fascinating book, The Flower of Life, and he had several other companion works he came out with. You familiar with him?
No, I don't know his work.
Oh, Melchizedek. He goes into sacred geometry and the ancient mysteries and the flower of life pattern a lot and such.
Okay.
But I saw a video and what he was speaking about was realizing like the space of the heart, that he had come to this kind of profound realization of the space of the heart and how the whole world was within the heart. And he was talking along that line. I'll have to send you this link to Melchizedek. He's very well known. I want to get his address and send him a copy of my book. I think he'd really appreciate it. And he was talking about the heart space. So it is, I think, going to start emerging in other literature, I hope. I think it's really important that it does.
Yeah. It has such a... there's so many different elements to this. I mean, first of all, there's the idea that that consciousness, rather than being produced from the neurochemical activities and the biological and chemical activities of the brain, is actually manifested and essentially stepped down and from higher dimensional realms levels of being and manifests within the physical body and produces life and consciousness in the physical body. And that's a very different perspective, radically different perspective. But also it's this, I see more and more, you know, one of the things that when we first started to study esotericism through the fourth way, one of the things that really, you were writing your thesis about certain psychological ideas about consciousness from Gurdjieff's perspective, and your doctoral dissertation had to do with that, and you provided a very good critique of modern consciousness theorizing and presented this alternative understanding of consciousness, and really focused on the psychological aspect of Gurdjieff's teaching. And so from that, as I worked with you on, I was helping you with your dissertation and doing my own master's thesis along the same lines. From that, I certainly bought into the psychological perspective in Gurdjieff's teaching. But there was this whole other cosmological aspect of his teaching that I realized I didn't really grasp. It was very complicated and very alien in a sense to my thinking. But I was willing to suspend my judgment. I knew that I didn't know whether or not it was true or not. And as I think we both had the same experience, as we progressed in studying the fourth way and Gurdjieff's teaching, it became very apparent that the Gurdjieff's contention that really the separation of psychology and cosmology is in a sense it's an artifact, it's an artificial division, because psychology is implicated in cosmology and cosmology is implicated in psychology and his teaching. And I think really that whole perspective, that understanding underlies all esoteric teachings and really speaks to the heart of how radically different they are from modern psychological ideas and from modern physics. Like, once you have that perspective that the cosmos isn't just some sort of thing out there that consists of dead, inanimate, unintelligent matter, and where everything's just sort of bouncing around, and you realize that everything is in some way infused with life and with varying degrees of consciousness, and that it's not uniform, that there are different gradations of materiality and consciousness, then your whole perspective on everything changes, and it's, you have to have that in a way to be able to, well, not in a way, you actually have to have that perspective to be able to come to this idea that consciousness isn't being produced in us, it's being stepped down and manifested through us, in us, and this is in against the entirety of modern thought in a way, but it's such a brilliant explanation, because it makes sense of so many of the enigmas that confront both modern psychologists and physicists, and it's very exciting in that sense, because you can see how importing this perspective into modern thinking would radically shift, I think, the understanding of both psychology and physics in ways that it needs to be shifted. Like, I think I think the death knells of materialism have already been sounded, but it's, in a way, there's a lack of a comprehensive perspective to address what needs to be addressed to really kill it off. I mean, in a sense, I think that's one of the real values, that's intellectually, that's the great value of your work, is that you provide a very plausible and, as they say, a coherent and lucid model of consciousness and the cosmos, consciousness, which in both cosmological and psychological terms, in both the terms of the cosmos and in terms of a human being. And so it provides a radically different set of lenses to examine pretty much all and everything. And from that perspective, I think we can achieve a new synthesis of mysticism and esotericism and modern science and modern thinking. I think that once you have this perspective of from a mystical esoteric perspective, you see how everything in modern thinking is, despite the brilliance of science's advances, it's all very limited and it's somehow fundamentally incorrect about the most important thing, which is the nature of consciousness.
Yeah. The study of the heart doctrine and the study of the zero point teaching. I mean, both of those, in a way, provide an alternate model of the structure of existence, in a way, it's an alternate model of the structure of existence that we ourselves have this kind of divine spark. That in a way we come down out of higher worlds. The ultimate nature is a divine spark. And then that's brought down into the spiritual heart and the spiritual self. And then that comes down into a psychical heart and then into a physical heart that a human being has for their four dimensions of existence or planes of existence. The divine, the spiritual, the psychical, and the material. So really the heart has this kind of higher dimensional nature, and behind the material heart is this kind of higher dimensional physics produced out of this zero point center, and that it's actual there, that this somehow actually produces the electrical pulse within the heart, and it brings life into the body, and it's connected to the breath. And oh, that's the dog here. He's taking a yawn.
I was wondering what that was.
Oh yeah, the dog here yawn. Okay. So the idea that
I thought that was maybe the sound of a higher dimension manifesting in your. In your living room or something.
So that a human being is ensouled through the heart, and then descriptions are so valuable of the self as like a point or the hundredth part of the dimension of a horse's hair. Like the self is like this point source, zero point source, as I would describe it, like a point so small you can't see it. And then the idea in the yogic teachings that there's a bliss sheath in the heart, and it's a mass of unemergent light. So imagine a human being as a holographic system. Well, then this is a model of there's a sphere of unemergent light. So that provides the kind of the laser beam or the reference beam to create the holographic human experience. So there's so much to, if we actually see how different mystical teachings and religions all bring us back to understanding the mystery of the nature of the heart as a way in which we know God and know ourselves. And so then to see that human consciousness, it's not being produced by matter in the head, but really it originates out of the heart, and in the human body it's connected to blood flow in the body, that these energies that ensoul us as living beings, they circulate through the blood, and that brings consciousness into our body through our blood. So if a person uses part of their brain, well, the blood flows there. Or you eat a big meal and your blood flow concentrates in your stomach. So blood flow is related to consciousness. So the heart doctrine presents this whole alternative scientific model of the origin and nature of human consciousness. And it's based on all these mystical studies, but it's a framework of ideas. Like, as you say, Jim, it explains it explains a lot of things which are otherwise inexplicable and which are enigmas. And it's all consistent, and there's no kind of contrary information that kind of says why this cannot be so or isn't a reasonable hypothesis. So there's a God hypothesis or a soul hypothesis, and that is the human consciousness is a manifestation of this living entity or jiva atma or a monad or a divine spark within in the human being, that there's some kind of zero-point source, meaning something of such small dimension that it's beyond our perception. And then somehow from that, the divine spark, and then we have a spiritual nature, a psychical nature, and a material nature. So it's a fascinating alternative view of what a human being is, because the last century of Western philosophies taught us that we simply higher animals or primates, which evolved through fortunate random mutations and genetic changes, and that a human being lives and dies with the material body, and that a human being has no essential I, like any truly singular I. Whereas mystical teachings suggest you do. Most people think they do. They, in a way, you intuitively feel that you do, even though modern science doesn't conceive of how that could be so. So mystical teachings, in a way, provide a model of why one would have that experience of the continuity of one's consciousness through one's life. Like, if I look back on my life, it's like it's the same me, it's the same consciousness in a certain way. There's something that is constant through my life changes and the things that happen to me. There's something there that is constant through that process. So in a way, the jiva atma, the living entity, the spiritual soul, somehow is connected to the dimensions of the human heart. And this concept is in all the religions and mystical teachings of the human race, including native teachings and Hindu teachings and Kabbalah and Judaism and Christianity and the secret doctrine of Blavatsky and in Gurdjieff and other sources. It's not in New Age teachings for the most part, which also have focused more on the mind studies. People haven't really come to the idea that there is an actual I within the human heart, and it's not meant just metaphorically. That it's saying there's an actual physics to this. So that's all in the book, The Heart Doctrine, and I do encourage people. My website, by the way, Jim, is www.zeropoint.ca. not .com.
Oh yeah, sorry, .ca, yeah.
It's getting exciting to imagine having God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine produced in a similar format. This time I'm going to kind of get it into print, and I'm going to have a proof copy and take a couple weeks to go through that and do some additional edits, you know?
Yeah.
Try to get the bulk of it done.
And what, is there a third book in this series?
The Heart Doctrine, the book two of the Heart, the Within Without from Zero Point mm-hmm. series is the Microcosm, Macrocosm book.
Okay.
Yeah, which I want to go back and revise, but a lot of the material in that book is also in all the parts on science in the Microcosm, Macrocosm book are the same science material as is in the God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine book.
Okay.
It's the same outline of modern science.
Okay.
Yeah, so the material is copied between those books, but the Microcosm, Macrocosm, it looks at Kabbalah in more detail and the Secret Doctrine, the Gurdjieff teaching and Vedic teachings, all about like creation metaphysics, exploring the idea that we explore so often. It is the significance of the number 1 divided by 137. And that number, that's a profoundly interesting number, and there's a lot of enigmas about that number. Firstly, in a way, I would say that that number is the best kind of numerical representation of the secret teaching of the secret doctrine. That in the secret doctrine, it kind of attempts to explain how a higher dimensional metaphysics produces the physics of everyday life. Okay, so, and creation is through intelligent design, but there are principles inherent to the patterns of intelligent design. And the main principle is symbolized, if you imagine white light divided by a three-sided prism, and it gives you a spectrum of seven colors. So the idea of the one divided by three, seven. So we could represent that by the number 1, 3, 7. So in our equation, if you take the one in the numerator, the one represents the absolute, the kind of ultimate God or source of existence, which is beyond existence. Okay, so it's a transcendental one. Okay, but then when you talk about how that one manifests as creation, it manifests certain patterns of creation and design in all living beings, according to occult teachings. And that pattern of design is best represented by, in my view, as I understand it, the numbers 1, 3, 7. Yeah, 1, 3, 7. And it's analogous to how white light divided by a prism gives a spectrum of seven colors, even though later I would describe that somewhat differently. So this notion then of the one divided by 1, 3, 7, and today as we go into the secret doctrine teachings, I'm going to explain how this applies in the study of the secret doctrine. So I'm trying to come back to what were we talking about before I got off starting to talk about 1 divided by 1, 3, 7. Can you recall where?
Well, I think we started talking.
Oh, I was talking about microcosm, macrocosm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how that book focuses on that pattern of metaphysics.
Right.
Of 1, 3, and 7, as you find that explained in four main sources: Kabbalah, the secret doctrine, Gurdjieff, and Vedic teachings. And they all have that same pattern, so it has such profound significance. So microcosm goes into that in more detail, and other aspects of the idea of the microcosm and the macrocosm. And then part three of that series was going to be called Triune Monads in Seven-Dimensional Hyperspace.
Okay, that's what I was wondering about. Okay, yeah.
Book three.
Yeah.
Because, and it's what I'd like to be working at, like what I'm doing now, interested in. But it's trying to actually elaborate this model of there being like a monadic essence, which it has kind of seven zero-point centers, differentiated out of 1 zero-point center, and this little element is established in hyperspace. Okay, so that's a God spark within the human being, is this little monadic essence, and it's got seven holes dug in space, which we'll kind of talk about. It's got this sevenfold zero-point inherent structure. And it's similar to what physicists imagine, where they describe little Calabi-Yau spaces, seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces down at Planckian levels of existence. So they describe a similar concept. But Blavatsky suggests that the human being has such a kind of a point origin, or it's a divine spark or element within them, and that is established in higher dimensional space. And then that entity has certain spin properties, because these little mini black holes, they have spin. and the gods in higher dimensional space, they're described as the ceaseless breath, which gives birth to the fiery whirlwinds, and then the whirlwind, so there's kind of the rotation and movement, the cyclone of activity, the whirlwinds, and then Pohat, which I'll explain more in a moment, manifests the will of these divine intelligences, or the first seven breaths. And Pohat carries their energy, and Pohat runs circular errands. And so in Blavatsky, these 0-point centers within the monad are like whirling, they have rotary motion to them. So the monad has these inherent spin properties. And the effects of these are propagated into the surrounding ether. And the ether is also seven-dimensional. And this is very important in the secret doctrine, is that the hyperspace is seven-dimensional. Blavatsky calls it the eternal parent space. And she describes it as seven-skinned. So hyperspace is seven-dimensional. So the seven-dimensional monadic essence has these spin properties which are propagated into the ethers, where they cause symmetry breaking, which causes the condensation or manifestations of matter inherent to that level of the ether. Excuse me. And these ethers are of seven densities, so this can create seven densities of matter and energy surrounding a central vacated point or a 0-point center. So in a way, the monad in hyperspace with its spin properties, that entity can then become clothed in different bodies. And this is how mystical teachings depict us, in a way, as having come out of higher dimensions. It's like we come down into life out of what Gurdjieff calls the ray of creation. We come out of the one, and then the three, and then the six laws, and the 12 laws, and the 24, and we're kind of born into physical life on Earth, which Gurdjieff describes as under 48 laws. But then he describes man can become under the influence and control of the moon, and then he's under 96 laws. But there's a level of a human being that's related to the level of the planets and to the sun, and that's what a human being is in their essence. So that the psychology of a human being is related to the psychology of the ray of creation and different levels of this cosmic structure. So coming back, I was just explaining a little bit about book three of where the 0-point series will be going as I develop that material more over time. I hope to get back to revising Microcosm, Macrocosm, Jim, just to refine it and bring in my new material and such and keep moving through that series. I need to promote the Heart Doctrine more, and thank you for your fine commentary on it.
Oh, you're welcome. I just wanted to mention a couple of things that just came up as you were speaking. I don't know if you know this. I don't even know if I mentioned this to you. There's a book out, a version of Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, which is abridged and annotated by Michael Gomes. It came out last year. And it's published by Jeffrey Tarcher, Penguin. Very nice book and very interesting looking book. And it's trying to kind of condense the secret doctrine to its essence. And I don't know if you're aware of that version. It's definitely worth looking at.
Before we move on, like just to comment on that regard. Yeah, I'm very pleased to see that. I'll look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, because the Secret Doctrine is difficult. I like the book.
It's immensely
very
difficult.
Very hard to. It's not easy going. In a way, I think that's what's very valuable. I mean, I remember you telling me how you had to sort of dig and dig and dig when you were first reading this and going through it, and I'm, what is she talking about? I mean, part of it is too, is just the material is inherently difficult, but it's very complicated, and it's not easy going at all in terms of trying to access what she's really saying. In a sense, it's nice to have somebody give an informed commentary on it, because it makes it a little easier to kind of assimilate it, what she's saying. The other book I wanted to mention...
Oh, just before we move on, Jim, it's also, what's interesting is that, like, what I'm arguing a bit is that this most important concept of zero points and Leia centers has largely been ignored within the theosophical community and studies itself, and people haven't realized the importance of this.
That's like, very interesting, yeah.
Because most people going through the secret doctrine wouldn't find in it the zero-point teaching, which I found in it. And then once you know it, then you can find it more and more.
And also, this comes back to the point I was making earlier about Gurdjieff saying that cosmology was implicated in psychology and psychology was implicated in cosmology in his teaching, because that's exactly what you're saying about zero points, is that this is a both a cosmic and a psychological dynamic which accounts for creation on all levels of what we see as manifest creation, is that this is applicable, the same principle is applicable, same dynamic is applicable on an individual and a cosmological level. And I don't think anybody says that that I'm aware of.
No, I don't know anyone who does either, actually. I mean, that's, you know, even coming to the term microcosm, macrocosm. And what I'm writing in my writing is that both have singularity or zero-point origins. I don't know anyone else arguing that. You know?
Yeah. And
it's funny how people can imagine it for the universe, but they can't imagine it for the individual. But
yeah,
in a way, it's more unimaginable, really, that the universe would have emerged from a point than to imagine that a human being has such a point.
Yeah, I think that's entirely reasonable, actually, because
no more bizarre. Like,
yeah, we come from
bizarre.
Physically, we come from a fertilized egg. We know that, so it's not that much of it. Well, it's a stretch because our thinking about things, again, with what I was saying earlier, is so fundamentally, I think, wrong about things in our view of what the nature of creation and the universe and reality is that the universe is just some dead, inanimate, dumb, non-sentient collection of matter and energy, and really that's all wrong. I think I very firmly believe that that's all wrong, and I think it's sort of the, Ken Wilber talks about sort of the triumph of modernism and the tragedy of modernism, and the tragedy is that modernism has done away with the great chain of being, and that really it's only in modern times that people haven't believed in the great chain of being and a multi-leveled nature of creation, a multi-dimensional creation with higher levels of consciousness and being, and that it's a recently relative viewpoint which has kind of infused the conventional thinking and modern consciousness, is that somehow everything is uniform in the universe and that there are no higher levels, or that it's all imaginary, but when you have that perspective, it changes your understanding of everything, and you see how so much of what is taken as axiomatic in modern thought, like the idea that the Big Bang happened accidentally and that the universe is just an accidental creation, or that human beings are just descended through evolutionary processes and involve random mutations preserved by natural selection, and that consciousness is produced in the brain. I mean, all of these ideas are axiomatic to modern thinking, and yet all of them are basically assumptions. None of them are actually proven or have been observed. They're just assumptions about the nature of things, and I think they're all incorrect assumptions, essentially. That's a really astounding thing that you get when you have this alternative perspective, and it's the beginning of approaching everything in very different terms. It's interesting. The work that I'm working on, the problem of God's contracting universe, based on your work and trying to approach the science versus religion debate from a mystical and esoteric perspective, I see like a lot of what passes as debate is it's debate in terms that I don't even recognize as being true. So it's just kind of meaningless to me in a way. It's like it's drivel because people are arguing about things as if they were true when in fact I don't think they're true at all. So you know it's very weird in a way to survey so much of this intellectual debate and realize, well, it's got its meaning within its own parameters, but it's only such a small part of the picture. And how anyone can profess to have anything to say about the religion versus science debate without knowing the mystical and esoteric perspective is completely absurd to me. It's like you can't have an informed opinion about this without having carefully studied this perspective. I mean, I don't know many things in life, but I know that's true.
I was trying to think today as an example of this. Who, what authors really consider like the law of seven as a serious kind of scientific hypothesis to apply in studies of phenomena in nature? Like, what scientists would look at that kind of perspective?
Pause. Yes.
I think that, yeah.
Who does
in
that?
In modern times, it seems that people kind of want to multiply levels in random ways, I think, which takes people astray a bit. Like sometimes, you know, traditionally people talked of human beings as having seven chakras, seven vital chakra centers. And then someone else kind of, you know, in California can, you know, channel that they're really eight or 14 rather, and or 10. And then someone else can channel even more. They got a higher teaching. There's 14 chakras. Now there's 23, you know, and so a lot of stuff comes in and obscures the ancient archaic idea. As Blavatsky says in The Secret Doctrine, seven is the number of the divine mysteries. So who in science, I'm asking, or in your reading of science philosophy, Jim, who considers seriously the idea of the inherent sevenfoldness of creation? Because it seems to me that's not only a philosophical idea, but if it's true, it should have application in any department of knowledge we desire to look at. We should find application of those principles inherent to the processes and structures and functions of whatever phenomena we looked at. So, and that's in a way what we've tried to do, I think yourself and I, through our life, is to actually take seriously Gurdjieff's claim, as we understood it initially, that there were two fundamental cosmic laws, the laws of three and seven. And in a way, it seems such a childishly simple thing, but that is such an unbelievably profound and esoteric idea to really understand all that entails and the implication and the applications of that. And that's really profound. What we've attempted to do over the years is actually take that seriously and apply it in our examination of science and psychology and anything we come across. So we had that kind of perspective now for 30 years on trying to understand other phenomena. And it's such a valuable teaching.
It's incredibly valuable. And as you say, I mean, I don't know of anybody in modern science who really takes the ideas of the fundamental cosmic laws seriously or even gives any indication that they recognize them. But, you know, as you say, that's kind of underlies the whole thrust of the model that you're trying to put forth. Is you're trying to say, like, look, if we try to understand the nature of consciousness, the nature of psychology, and the nature of cosmology by applying this perspective, we should be able to arrive at certain predictions and certain understandings of things. And, you know, so go ahead. Let's try to assume this model. Let's try to apply it. And you know, that's that's the thrust of this, is that we're not saying that anybody should believe this blindly or accept it because, you know, Gurdjieff or Blavatsky or any other mystical or esoteric teacher or interpreter has said this. We're saying there's a profound model of creation and of consciousness that exists within these teachings, and we can extrapolate it, and we can apply this, and we can, I mean, Blavatsky and Gurdjieff were anticipating things 100 and 125 years ago that have been corroborated by modern science, and they're posing fundamental challenges to the assumptive framework of modern science, saying, no, you've got things completely upside down and inside out. You don't really understand what you're talking about. And again, my point is that I think it's worthwhile assuming this model and trying to apply it, and the first step in that, of course, is to communicate it to people. So it's sort of a, you know, we're starting. It's a sort of a bootstrap operation, but I see this as challenging our basic understanding of everything. But at the same time, it has to be held to some sort of empirical standards. I think, you know, that it is applicable, and I think it does explain many things. As I said before, if we could change our basic idea of what the nature of consciousness was, it would change everything in all departments of modern science and in all departments of modern thinking if we really started to have this fundamentally different view of what the nature of consciousness is. And you know, when you change the nature of your understanding of the nature of consciousness, you change your understanding of the nature of the universe. And all questions are illuminated in a completely different light and considered from a completely different perspective. It's interesting, like for instance, the law of three and the law of seven. Like anything in mystical and esoteric teachings, right, the idea of dying and being reborn, the idea that we're a microcosm of the macrocosm, again, all of these things, it depends on your level of consciousness and being and your level of understanding as to how you understand these things. They can have completely different meanings. Like the idea of being, of dying and being reborn, you know, some people say, well, I accepted Jesus Christ as my Savior, and I was baptized, and I was reborn in spirit, and now I accept Jesus as my Savior. But they haven't undergone a transformation of their consciousness and being. They've taken a decision, and they've gone through a process, and they've paid lip service, this is my own interpretation, of to an idea, which is much more profound than what they suspect. It's like when people talk about, oh, you know, man is made in the image of God, and skeptics and atheists and people who deny the existence of spirit mock that idea. But the perspective that you're presenting, that we're talking about, this is a very profound idea, which is very complicated and has all sorts of different levels of meaning and import, and it's not just a simplistic banal observation based on faith. It's something which expresses some sort of essential truth about the nature of psychology and cosmology and the nature of reality. So you can say that about almost anything that comes out of esotericism or mysticism. It can be trivialized and it can be understood by dumb people in dumb ways, but that doesn't mean that it isn't profound and it doesn't have profound implications. And that's, I think, what we've discovered through the past 30 years, is that the more you mine this material, the deeper it gets and the more you realize, oh my God, that, you know, even when you think you understand it, there's always different levels of application and interpretation that still exist to be discovered.
Yeah, there is. It strikes me like what initially led me into all these areas of investigation is this idea of human beings as being multidimensional beings. And in a way, I realized after time that there's so much evidence for that. Like, firstly, I had my own out-of-body experiences. And I talk to other people like yourself who've had out-of-body experiences, and you realize that hundreds of thousands of people have claimed it, and people have researched it and found evidences for claims related to it. And then other people have experiences where they're out of their bodies and they encounter other beings. So where are these other beings and where are these places that they say they experience? See, they claim they're in other dimensions, or they go down a tunnel into a realm of light and encounter spiritual beings. So from my point of view, in a way, all of these things we need a whole multidimensional model of the physics of the human being, because somehow we're interrelated to the cosmos at a higher level, like at a subtle level, like when you say how Gurdjieff relates consciousness and study of the cosmos. And now, as I see Gurdjieff, in a way, the consciousness and the self are associated with the sun, and it's like our higher self is in the sun. And Gurdjieff says that describes the sun as connected to our mental body. So it's like a spiritual body for the divine spark. So to attain to the level of the sun is to attain your spiritual body and have spiritual knowledge and spiritual discernment in things. So Gurdjieff says that the level of the sun is a level within ourselves. He says you don't have to go to the sun to know this level of what the sun is, because the sun is within us, at a certain level of our own being. And it's connected then to the heart. So, so it's like the idea, Gurdjieff also has an idea that, like, when souls die, he says they feed the moon. And see, in Gurdjieff's Ray of Creation, the moon's a very bad place to go. You're kind of enslaved there under 96 laws. And you're kind of devoured by lunatics, lunacy. The moon is like Gurdjieff describes the dark side of the moon as that where there's a gnarling and gnashing of teeth, like the hell world is the dark side of the moon. So then Gurdjieff says the moon feeds off living souls, and when there's wars and a lot of deaths, then the souls all feed the moon. So that a person's consciousness could, in a way, then pass to the moon. Or your consciousness could go into the astral realms which surround the planet, which could be certain paradise worlds in your astral body. So for Gurdjieff and other mystical teachings, we do have these subtle bodies, the three lower of which are usually referred to as the physical, astral, and mental bodies. And each of these three lower bodies is said to reflect on a lower level, on the material level, the nature of three higher being bodies, which in theosophy are the Buddhic, the Manas, and the Atmic principle. And the Buddhic consciousness is connected to the heart, and that's related to the higher emotional center, related to the astral body. And the Manas is higher mind, and it's related to the intellectual, the mental body. And the Atmic principle is, it manifests will, and that is reflected in the physical body, and the physical body can make things manifest through will. So that in this model, a human being is a higher dimensional being. So I realized long ago, Jim, if there are other worlds we can go into and such, well, there has to be a physics of it. Like, you can't have those worlds. There has to be a physics of it, by definition, in my way of thinking. You know, in a way, it might be a metaphysics, like it's a physics beyond our current physics. But there has to be a physics to these kind of phenomena and experiences. There has to be a science to it. And in the literature, it seems mainly people are kind of prove that phenomena exist. And then you have all the skeptics which kind of always challenge that, so that people end up spending all their time just arguing that the phenomena exist. And no one kind of moves forward to try to understand, well, what could be the higher dimensional physics that could produce this? And that's kind of the line upon which I've worked for years, is to try to understand how could these things be possible. And it all seems to kind of come back to this higher dimensional holographic physics of the human heart. Like, it's an amazing concept.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you were asking what scientists like accept the law of three or seven or to investigate it, and I was thinking, well, there's a guy in that Jacob Needleman book where he edited where Gurdjieff and I don't know the exact title of it. Gurdjieff. It's a collection of essays in honor of Gurdjieff or something like that. And there's a scientist in there, Niculescu, Bazrab Niculescu, who wrote a very interesting piece. It's actually called Gurdjieff: Essays and Reflections on the Man and His Teaching, by Needleman and George Baker are the editors. And Niculescu goes in and talks a little bit, and he's a physicist, and he talks about how when Gurdjieff was describing the law of seven and the discontinuities in the law of seven and the need that nothing unfolds in a continuous fashion, that there are gaps where there have to be shocks in order for an octave to progress. This is his formulation of the law of seven. And Niculescu says that essentially Gurdjieff was presenting these ideas at the beginning of the 20th century or the late part of the 19th century, and he had anticipated the idea of the quantum and of quantum realities. And I thought, well, that was pretty interesting. And his essay is very, very interesting. And in that essay, I found out that he wrote a book called Science, Meaning, and Evolution, The Cosmology of Jacob Bohm. And I actually just bought this book. I just got it the other day, and I just flipping through the table of contents, and he has a chapter, Structure and Self-Organization in the Bohmian Universe, and the first two parts are the threefold structure, and then the sevenfold self-organization of reality, and he has a statement at the beginning. He says, Bohm basically says that the structure of reality is based on these very simple basic principles of the one, the three, and the seven, which again comes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? It's amazing.
Wow, Bohm says that.
Yeah, and I've been flipping
wow,
through this book.
Wow, I didn't know that.
You've got to read this book, Chris, because it's like, I mean, it's entirely consistent with the material that you've been developing. I have to give you this book to read. It looks quite amazing, and it's, he has selections from Bohm's work, and you know, like Bohm was uneducated. He was a shoemaker and had a series of mystical experiences where he basically was able to apprehend the higher dimensions and came back sort of with the knowledge and the truth that had been imparted to him through these mystical experiences. And yet, as I say, he was not educated at all. And so this book by Niculescu is a commentary, and as I say, he's a physicist. It's a commentary on Bohm's universe, and again, I just been flipping through it while we were talking. I was just looking at it the other day. I just got it, and I'm thinking, well, again, you know, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, there's an amazing consistency in these accounts. And again, going back to the point I was making earlier, how anybody can profess to make an informed commentary on the existence of the soul or spirit or God without having examined the mystical and esoteric tradition is beyond me. It's utterly absurd for anybody to put forth that they have some sort of insight into these questions unless they've examined this material. And I think most people of discerning intellect and any kind of curiosity, if they really studied this material, they'd realize, like, wow, you know, there's an entirely different perspective here. And I guess part of the problem is that it resonates with some people and it doesn't resonate with others. But I just, I can't see anybody examining this with an open mind and saying, oh, there's nothing to it. It's all nonsense.
Yeah, Jim, I think I saw that when I taught at York University. Like, students just loved it. Like, it was a whole new way of thinking, and it, you know, you couldn't prove it wrong or right, but that's not even the point. It's a new way of trying to understand things, eh? And people loved it. It was so exciting. It was new. It tied things together. You know, it is thrilling for people to hear it. That's why, like, when I was at York, my teaching became, like, so popular, you know. I remember I used to have students, they used to bring their mothers with them, you know.
Yeah, and
big people,
same,
you know.
Same thing with
it's
us.
So
like,
interesting.
When we went to school to study psychology, I mean, I sort of thought this was what I was getting into, you know. I mean, I wasn't quite that naive, but I thought I was getting into some sort of deep study of the nature of the psyche, you know, and instead it was a study of rats, you know, and I felt very dissatisfied with what I thought there were a lot of interesting ideas and attractive things in psychology, but there was something clearly missing in it, and you know, until I started studying esotericism, I mean, I'd read quite a bit of material about consciousness from philosophical perspectives, but it didn't really make any sense to me. It was all sort of big intellectual game, and once I began to be challenged to study consciousness within myself through a systematic approach that by adopting the fourth way teaching, it changed everything. And as you say, like I used to help you as your teaching assistant when you taught those courses. People love these courses because I think they thought that this is what they were signing up for when they were studying psychology. I mean, I think people recognize this is real psychology. This isn't the bullshit. This isn't the bullshit version that they give you in you know the standard curriculum. That you know, not that it's all wrong or worthless. I mean, you know, conventional psychology, there's lots of valuable things in it, but it's just so incomplete and it doesn't deal with the essential question which psychology should focus on, which is what is the nature of human consciousness.
Yeah, and related to that, is there an I?
An I
element of some type, but are we multidimensional beings? But all
yeah,
of that,
do we have a spirit? Or you know, is our spirit and soul real? You know, these aren't just something you can throw out because they're unscientific. I mean, that's completely absurd. You know, it's like about a year ago, I was sitting there and I was trying to write something, and I was thinking about modern psychology, and I was thinking about esoteric study of psychologists, and it struck me that, I mean, I think I knew it before, but it just struck me is that within psychology, nobody has really addressed the question of the I experience. What is the nature of I? You know, I mean, they've tried to dismiss it, but that's not an explanation of it, you know. that's pretend science, but they haven't really, you know, focused on what is this? This is like this intriguing question. I mean, it's the most self-evident thing in a certain way, as you say. Like everybody can say, well, from their own experience, like you know, well, my I is some sort of continuous sense of my identity, what you were talking about before. But it's a big question. It's an important question, and yet it hasn't really been examined by modern psychology, and it hasn't even really been theorized about in anything other than kind of the most superficial ways, I would say. Like, I mean, I don't want to be unfair to certain people. I'm trying to think of what it is in psychology. I guess some of the work on the ego and ego structures, it deals with the questions surrounding the I, but I don't think it really gets to the heart of the matter whatsoever.
No, it doesn't. Certainly doesn't get to the heart of the matter.
No.
Even look at your language, eh? Because that.
Yeah.
It's an appropriate metaphor. Yeah,
that was sort of intentional, but yeah.
No, it's like speaking off the top of your head, kind of.
Yeah, it's intellectualizing about things, and thinking about things without examining things and trying to observe them within yourself. I mean, that's the other thing about perhaps, you know, that people don't recognize, which is so important about the mystical and esoteric perspective, is that. To study these teachings, you have to study yourself and the world in terms of these teachings, and that means systematically studying yourself and trying to observe things that are in terms of the categories that are provided by whatever teaching you're following, but also through the illusory nature of what we take to be ourselves and our psychological capacities and our fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of our own consciousness, and that's very eye-opening and revolutionary. I mean, in a way, that's the biggest thing is to see through the illusory nature of the self.
Yeah, and I think with that is to realize our own multidimensional nature and the potential of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That we are, like Swami Prabhupada, he describes the spirit soul as inhabiting the body. So it's like a vehicle made of material energy, but the eye is not the vehicle. And he says that's a fundamental mistake of modern psychology. He says it's like they take the clothes and think that the clothes are the man.
Yeah.
But similarly, our clothes is, we're, in the Bible, it's referred to as the bodies of skin. That's in the Genesis when Adam and Eve are cast into the Garden of Eden. They're given bodies of skin. And so that's, yeah. So we got kicked out of the spiritual world and we're born into the physical world in a body of skin. So, but the eye is not the body. So, yeah. And that's what discernment leads one to. As you try to discern what the nature of I is, and you kind of realize, if you even go into it in meditation or just being self-aware, you kind of realize all that I is not. Like, I'm not my feet, I'm not my hands, I'm not my arms, I'm not my ears, I'm not this, I'm not my digestion, I'm all these things I am not. So you kind of strip away everything that I is not, and then what is the I? And the kind of thing that people come to is the eye is connected to the kind of sacred space of the heart. The eye is connected to this in this light consciousness, because consciousness is equated with light. And the light of the spiritual spark is our consciousness. So people come to, and they come to the experience of emptiness and the kind of nothingness, and it's so amazing how the concept that, just as the scientists talk of vacuum genesis, how our universe emerged out of nothingness, mystics similarly describe human beings as kind of emerging out of nothingness. I love that Sufi quote where he says, "Not since God brought man out of nothingness have we ceased to be travelers." And in a way, it's like going back to the idea, Jim, of microcosm, macrocosm, that, well, just like the scientists believe that the universe emerged out of the quantum vacuum, or a realm of nothingness, from a singularity point, and it grew from within without. And then you find that that's the same concept expounded in the secret doctrine and in Kabbalistic teachings, is the same concept.
Yeah, I think that the whole idea of nothingness is something which, to me, is relatively a later development in my understanding of things. Is that it was something that I didn't recognize for many years, and now I see how essential it is, and how, again, it's in so many different teachings, and it's quite profoundly described and commented upon in various teachings. That was actually one of my favorite parts this time reading the Heart Doctrine, is when you're talking about the Kabbalistic concept of Ein Sof and the different aspects of there's 0, 0, 0 and 0, 0, 0. It's like the tripartite nothingness that underlines everythingness, which is really quite profound. And again, it's so consistent with other teachings, and also consistent with this idea of like vacuum, the quantum vacuum in modern physics. I mean, it's different angles, I think, on. I hesitate to say the same thing, because you're describing different, you're trying to describe something physical, but you're also trying to describe something spiritual, and you know, people have warned about sort of mixing the two, but I think it's, I don't think it's a coincidence that you know, these radically different approaches have come to such similar ideas about things, and again, the zero point is the dynamic which applies to this manifestation of everything out of nothingness is quite coherent and brilliant and fascinating kind of explanation for all of this.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's shocking that Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine was essentially saying this, because the secret, the stanzas of Zen, which are the basis of The Secret Doctrine, they begin before creation has happened, and it's during what are called the nights of Brahma, where the creator is asleep. So everything is described as absorbed in non-being, the one being. So kind of during the stanzas of Dan open with creation latent in non-being before the universe is created. And that's kind of describing this, what was in the vacuum before the vacuum genesis happened. And then it describes the instigation of creation and the universe emerging from a point source. And even in 88, Blavatsky used the image of a circle with a point in its center. And she said, this depicts the origin of the universe. So if you took that seriously in 1888, based on Blavatsky, you would have predicted the singularity point origin of our universe, which is now the concept that scientists accept, is that there was a singularity point origin, and that it grew from a point emerging at Planckian levels of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So this concept is now accepted in science of the zero-point origin, and that's what Blavatsky was saying in 1888, and she was describing the quantum vacuum that existed before creation occurred, and which also maintains the foundation for all living phenomena. Because the root principles of creation aren't simply there before creation is created and then come back at the end, but they continue their eternal existence the whole time through, and that these processes in higher dimensional space, hyperspace, these sustain phenomena that occur in the material world. So the root principles are the background all the time against which the phenomena of life occur.
Well, you're saying, you know, Blavatsky was writing this in 1888, and she was drawing on sources, who knows how old they were. And then there's that quote that you have on your website from Jonathan Cott when he's talking to Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, and Kushner says, you know, that the Kabbalists so long ago, you know, Jonathan Cott asked him about cosmologists have speculated that the first explosive moment of the birth of the universe, everything that exists or ever will exist, was contained within a single spark of energy, smaller than an atom's nucleus and ruled by a single primordial law. And Kushner says one dot, a point of light. Perhaps the fact that contemporary cosmologists talk about a dimensionless point of light from which all beings sprang, and that the Kabbalists long ago came up with precisely the same image. And then in brackets he says, in the 14th century, Moses de Leon spoke of a hidden supernal point whose primal center is the innermost light of a translucent subtlety and purity beyond comprehension, close brackets, means that this awareness comes from something we all carry within us. I mean, so in the 14th century Kabbalists, we're talking about, you know, this point from which everything emerged, and, you know, modern cosmologists discovered this, quote-unquote, in the 20th century. Well, wait a minute, you know, like, there's two examples, and there are many more, you know, Blavatsky and Kabbalists, who clearly, you know, not only knew of this, but, you know, commented on it in an intelligent fashion. So how do you explain that?
Well, the easiest way to explain it is that science is now offering us another way of understanding the ancient wisdom teachings, Science is actually confirming the concepts that were articulated in these mystical sources.
And it
all relates back to what you were saying about relating consciousness and cosmology, like, how could these Kabbalists have this knowledge, kind of? And I would say through direct revelation, like through inner experience. And this is like the discernment that when people experience these things, they try to discern what they experience and the kind of tradition of people who experience these types of states. So the mystic kind of arrives at, like, it's like Renee Weber says in her book about how the mystic is the daring explorer who kind of includes himself in the equation, because they include their own consciousness in the equation. And in a way, they realize, have insights into these things through their own experiences. And that's what kind of, and mystical teachings, as Gurdjieff says, they can come to us from above, like from outside of life. That Blavatsky says of the stanzas of the Zen that are in the Secret Doctrine, she says they were passed by the Lords of Light to the first human beings to arise at the beginning of the fifth root race on planet Earth in Central Asia. So she says that the stanzas were actually dictated by these sons of Lords of Light at the beginning of our round as a mystery teaching. So in that case, the stanzas come from outside of life, and then it's for us to try to grasp their meaning if we can. I can see why the Secret Doctrine is so secret. Because a person reads it, and it's still a secret to you.
Well, it's the same with Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, you know. Like, he can read it and not get it at all. Like, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of profound ideas in it, but, you know, you can read it and completely miss it all. So, and yet it's interesting, because, I mean, Gurdjieff says the same thing in Beelzebub's tales, is he's telling us that throughout human history, these sacred messengers have come from above to enlighten human beings, to teach them and to, you know, to bring down this higher knowledge, and, you know, with varying effects, like, you know, these ideas enter life, and they have a certain positive effect, and then they start to deviate in terms of consistent with what Gurdjieff calls the law of seven or the law of the octave. They go off and they become unrecognizable, or they turn into something diametrically opposed to what, you know, they originally were intended to convey. But it, you know, this idea that, again, this is my overwhelming objection based on mystical, one of my overwhelming objections based on mystical and esoteric teachings to dumb evolution, and is that no, things have come to human beings from these higher dimensions throughout human history. I'm quite convinced of that, and so it's not like life doesn't, human consciousness and human beings have not just developed in terms of the standard evolutionary model, you know, blindly and through happenstance and circumstance and, you know, and random mutations and preserved by natural selection. Like, that describes something, I think, that's happening, but it's not the complete story. It's not even close to being the complete story, you know, and there's a whole alternative understanding that could be achieved if you examine the esoteric and mystical teachings and if you develop the vehicles to apprehend these things directly. I mean, that's how these people knew these things, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago, is that they developed the vehicles of higher consciousness and being, which exist within us in a latent state, and they were able to apprehend and directly take knowledge from these higher dimensions. I mean, somebody like Bohm, sometimes it happens spontaneously, like this guy who was a shoemaker and there was a beam of light in a pewter dish, I think, it was sort of set his moment of cosmic consciousness off, and he entered these higher realms. I mean, there's all sorts of examples of this in human history. And yet, what is this uneducated shoemaker describe? He describes a world of, governed by the laws of three and seven. Well, how interesting is that, eh? That's exactly consistent with what other people who have worked to develop consciousness and being systematically have come to the same conclusion. Now, anywhere else, you know, that kind of confluence of narratives would lead somebody to believe that somebody has stumbled onto some sort of truth or that has arrived at some sort of a truth, you know. And yet, these truths are just denied a priori, like people just say, oh, it's mystical and dismiss it, like, you know, like as if that label somehow invalidates the what's being said. No, you can't do that. You have to You have to study what's being said. You have to try to understand it in its own terms, and then you have to make an informed decision. And until you do that, you should just shut up and not say anything. That's what I find quite maddening about the whole attitude towards mysticism and esotericism and modern thought, is that people make all these learned pronouncements about things, and they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, like, Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science.
Hmm.
Like, that's what I work under, that title. And what it's unusual, because people say mystical science or spiritual science. How can you have those? Aren't those, like, science and mysticism? They're opposites. And really, I'm saying that modern science is fundamentally flawed in all its materialist and reductionist assumptions, and it's in its denial of human multiple dimensional existence and all the evidences of psychical phenomena, and ignoring of all these evidences that do provide evidence that we are multidimensional beings. So I think modern science has largely become a fraud science, where it's ruled by dogma, like Darwinian materialist evolution is like a dogma of modern times, and it's not supported by the evidences. But it's promissory science, always saying they're going to explain it, but they never can. And there's just more and more enigmas.
Yeah.
So, sorry, I'm losing my point a bit, what I was trying to say.
Well, no, I think you said it very well. As you said, like, you know, that...
Yeah, and then we don't understand what religion is, because people have been portrayed that religions are just these kind of irrational belief systems with different methods of worship, and religion causes hatreds between people, and they use different words for God, and they can't all be right, and
they're based on faith.
They're based on faith, yeah, and they're irrational, and it causes conflict in the world. Okay, so people then, the fraud science, and then we have fraud religion, and really we need that third element, kind of mystical science, that kind of, you know, have a mystical perspective to understand the phenomena of science, and within science, you know, one can have a mystical perspective and look for metaphysical causes underlying the physical phenomena which manifest in our day-to-day lives and worlds. Like, it always amazed me how one in life has remarkable synchronicities. And I think of what a synchronicity is, in a way, where it's a pattern of meaning is made manifest in phenomena on a totally different level or seeming realm. Like, for instance, Carl Jung has a patient describing a dream about a scarab beetle, and then there's a knocking at the window pane of Carl Jung's office, and he goes and in flies a scarab beetle, just like according to what the woman was dreaming of in her dream and the importance of that in the therapy at that time with that woman. So how did the importance and meaning of that Carl Jung with this woman in therapy going through her emotional processes in her life and her image life, how did that make manifest a scarab beetle arriving at the window and knocking at that precise time and then kind of entering the room? There has to be a whole higher dimensional physics to this whole process that such things are possible. Like, see, we have no way in modern science of understanding meaningful patterns of synchronicity in people's lives and how the same themes are repeated in medium of such different natures, you know. I know just in my life, like now I have all these meaningful coincidences so often around the numbers 137 or 1137 or different numbers along that line in my life occur to me, even though not all the time. They'll come and it'll be very significant, and then it'll pass away. But all kinds of other meaningful coincidences and what happens that shows events in one's life there's a whole interrelated pattern and meaning and direction and causes and influences, which is just way beyond our modern perception or understanding that the events of that occur are somehow all interrelated manifestations of mind that somehow are interconnected. And that these things, are interconnected. And that's a whole level of reality that we haven't begun to understand. But mystical teachings can give us insights into understanding that.
Well, one of the interesting things is that you're talking about something that's seemingly meaningfully connected, but acausally connected. And I think one of the things that when you begin to discuss with anybody who's gone on any sort of a journey of self-examination and discovery through a mystical and an esoteric teaching, what you find over and over again is people often will tell you that at the beginning you have all sorts of meaningful coincidences that recur or that in certain seem to involve certain themes and it's sort of part of the process. It's almost like there's some sort of intelligence behind it all, and some sort of humor. Like that in my own life, this is exactly what happened to me. Is I had all these kind of meaningful coincidences, but also so kind of events that made me think that it's kind of like somebody was having a good laugh with me too. Like that there was some sort of joke behind all this, and kind of pointing out gently that I took myself too seriously and that I was going to have to get over myself in significant ways to begin to, to even be on the journey to any sort of real understanding of anything. Interesting coincidences. I remember way back when we were first studying the fourth way and you were living in Kitchener and I was living in Ottawa and you had come to visit your daughter in Ottawa. And my friend Paul was over, and we were talking about meaningful coincidences, and we were trying to think of the title of the book by Arthur Koestler about coincidences, and both of us had read it, and we just couldn't think of the title for some reason, which is very unusual for me, because I, in those days, I didn't often forget the name of a book, especially one that I'd read, so I said, well, Chris is in town, I'm going to give him a call and ask him, and so I phoned you, and I said, Chris, what was the name of that book, by Arthur Koestler about coincidence, and you burst out laughing and said, you know what I'm doing? This is amazing. I was sitting here. I had been preparing a lecture on synchronicity, Jung's concept of synchronicity last week, and this girl came by my office who had been interested in coincidences, and I thought at the time I want three meaningful coincidences to happen to me before I finished preparing this, and so this girl came by, and that was the first one, and then it was the second event, and I was just working on it now, and you phoned, and this is sort of the third one, and it's like, the book is called The Roots of Coincidence, but I mean, it was amazing that, that we had that kind of coincidence around coincidences. I mean, it was just like too good to be true in a sense. It was too funny.
Yeah, coincidences around coincidences. Exactly. That was a remarkable experience. I remember that so vividly, even now, like 35 years later.
Yeah.
I was sitting at a table at Lori's place visiting her, and I was just in my mind, I had the thought, okay, I've had these two coincidences, and now I want to have a third. And then just at that moment, you asked and you wanted the title of Koestler's book, The Roots of Coincidence. Yeah, that's so funny. And it's so funny, like, you talk about another coincidence of coincidences. Like, it's so funny how this number of 137 has played such an enigmatic role in modern physics. And it's related to what they call the fine structure constant in physics. And how in the book by David Peet on synchronicity, the bridge between mind and matter, he tells the story of Linus Pauling when he went to the hospital and was admitted to room 137.
No, no, it's It's Wolfgang Pauli.
Sorry, Wolfgang Pauli, yeah, who worked with Jung on, the physicist who worked with Jung on coincidences,
yeah.
And he went to the hospital, and his room number was 137, and he felt that he would never get out again, or he would die there, which is what happened. And I read somewhere else that some physicists saying that, like, oh, I wish I could find this quote. It's in the new version of the Secret Doctrine book. Just a second, I'm going to see if I... But it's a physicist saying that if you want to remind physicists how little they know, you put the equation 1 over 137 on their door. And he makes a comment. And that's supposed to remind them of how little they know. How they don't understand these mysteries.
I just bought this book by Arthur Miller called 137. Jung, Pauli, and the Pursuit of a Scientific Obsession, and it's the story of their relationship, and Pauli's obsession with the number 137. My understanding was, and I may be wrong, I think Eddington was also obsessed with this number. I know that Eddington was obsessed with the number, and I think this is it. That you know, he just could not figure this out, what it meant.
Yeah, and he worked it out, apparently, and it came out to 136. And then he said then that the constant, alpha constant itself, which is, in physics, the alpha constant is this number, 1 divided by 137.
Right.
He said, oh, the alpha constant itself was 137.
Okay.
And they used to calling him Eddington plus one. Because he kind of like said 136, and then he added, like, this is alpha is equal to, and then, the alpha was one more, so it was added, and it was 137. So,
well, I mean, in terms of the mystical significance of 137, isn't that interesting that of all the numbers in the world, that, that these guys, that this number 137 would have such mystifying significance to them, like that they couldn't, you know, that Pauli approached Jung, you know, to try to figure. Pauli was very interested in meaningful coincidences and kept coincidence journals too.
It's amazing all these. Synchronicities around that number, how that number like was written up in this book by Pete on synchronicity and all tying into Pauli, the physicist who studied with Jung. So there's that whole, and then I didn't realize that until recently that this is this number, 1 divided by 137, the fine structure constant. It's the alpha constant of the of nature, and it's a function of three major factors. The first is the speed of light.
Right.
The second is Planck's constant, which is a measure of mass or of discreteness.
Right.
Like material discreteness, and the charge on an electron.
Wow.
Which is like electron E, so the electrical charge on an electron. And those are three fundamental constants in nature. And you put those in ratio to each other, and they come out to this number, 1 divided by 137.
Wow.
And it's somehow that fine structure constant is related to how matter manifests out of nothingness. Like if that were altered, then you wouldn't have the materialization.
Wow.
Of phenomena, and it's called the fine structure constant. Another interpretation, they say, one out of every 137 electrons gets a photon and jumps into a higher orbit.
Are you kidding?
That process by which that happens pertains to that ratio.
Wow.
So it has these kind of profound inner meanings, and it's the most unique constant of the fundamental constants of nature, because all the other constants are measured in particular units, like the speed of light is measured, 300,000 kilometers per second.
Right.
Okay. Whereas the fine structure constant is a dimensionless. It's not in units, because when they you the equation wipes out all the, cancels out all the units, so it all adds up to zero, and all you have is this kind of dimensionless number, 1 divided by 137.
Well, we could probably spend an entire 2-hour show talking about the implications of that, or like speculating on. I mean, that's entirely in keeping with God, science, and the secret doctrine, and what you explore in that. I don't know if you got this message from me, Chris, but
yeah.
I have to go now, because we had a huge win at our work last week. We won an enormous trial and an enormous amount of money for our clients, which is very good. So I have to attend a dinner to celebrate this thing. So I'm going to say goodbye.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for being here. And
that was a really, really interesting program, a really interesting discussion. And let's come back and talk about God, science, and the secret doctrine on the next program, and have you continue your presentation that you started before. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, we'll do that. That's good.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, Jim, thanks.
I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay,
goodbye.
Okay, well, I guess I'm on alone here. I'll open up the phone lines, and then I still have 20 minutes left if anyone would like to call in. I have the number 888-815-9756. Otherwise, I'll just continue on with some discussions and such. I ended up talking about this the alpha constant, which is the first constant of the constants of nature, and how it's this number, 1 divided by 137. And I'm explaining that number, the 1 divided by 137, in a way that depicts the metaphysics of the secret doctrine as a teaching. In a way, it is also described as the number representing Kabbalah, okay, which is supposed to be 137. But in Kabbalah, what one has is, there are 10 spheres or circles, and there's the first three are called the supernal triad, and they're separate. They're in the metaphysical realm. And then when creation happens, you have created 7 sephira or spheres below, and the first three, they reflect a downward turn triangle relative to the triangle of the first three. So it's like as above, the triune above turn down and fall into matter and manifest inversely below. And then what you have, you can have the next three sephira, you can also create into a triangle. And that's a lower reflection of the triangle above. So, and then the final product of the whole tree of life is the 10th Sephira, Malkuth, which sometimes you put a cross in it because it represents the element earth, or what is made manifest. Okay, so one way of looking at Kabbalah is firstly, the first three sephira form an upward turn triangle. The next three sephira form a downward turn triangle. The next three form another downward turn triangle. And the 10th is a product of the whole inner process. Okay, so, and in Kabbalistic teaching, this is a model. This is... Hello?
Yes,
hello,
hi. Hi, Chris? Christopher?
Yeah, please. Welcome.
Yes, hi, this is... Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Yeah, hi, this is John Francis speaking. How are you doing?
Hi, John. How are you? Nice to hear from you.
Great program. I really really appreciate what you're doing. And I was just thinking that how it takes listening to what you're saying many, many times, and each time I listen, I get it at a deeper and deeper level, and I begin to understand it a little bit, what you're saying.
That's such an amazing process, isn't it, John? Like, I found that through my life with like really profound things, you realize them over and over again ever more deeply. Like that's part of what the process involves, eh? Like I find I go back and I reread the Heart Doctrine and I'm just like, wow, I'm illuminated again more by it because I see it even more clearly, you know? And understanding these things, there's level upon level of kind of illumination and insight and understanding that grows, you know?
Mm-hmm. So it really is helpful every time you sort of give an overview. You introduce your program every 2 weeks with an overview. So I find it very helpful, even if it may seem repetitive to some people who are listening. I find it very helpful to keep, you know what I'm saying?
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, because I do. I try always to, in a way, begin a bit from the beginning so that people, and then so each time I come back to certain ideas explained in a different way, a bit. Yeah.
So what I wanted to specifically ask about was I sort of got into the program a little bit late, maybe about 15 minutes in late, but I think I got in at just the right time for me. You were talking about the monadic essence and how that from that springs sevenfold holes in space. I hope I'm getting this sort of right. And then you were talking about spins and so forth, which was very, very helpful to me, this notion of spins and the vortex and so forth and the breath of gods. And I was wondering, and the Fohat, do you have that written down somewhere, or was it something that's coming out in your next book?
It's in my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I think I'm about a month away from having it released as a trade paperback. I'm in the process at the moment of converting it over and getting it all set up. So it's a revised version. I have whole sections of that because, it's like the ultimate source is a ceaseless breath. And then that goes through seven modifications, and that seven fiery whirlwinds, which are the seven luminous lords. And then Fohat is what connects intelligence to matter. So Fohat carries the impulse or will of, it manifests the intelligence of the seven luminous lords. And the Fohat are also sevenfold. And when Fohat spin their magic, they run circular errands. And Blavatsky describes wheels within wheels. Uh-huh. And those are sevenfold wheels. So the idea
that... Go ahead, continue.
I was just going to say the idea is that the monadic essence is this little, like, atomic element in higher dimensional space. And that it's actually got these kind of seven zero-point centers all tied up in its inner string patterns or nature. And so it's like the little mini black hole, seven-dimensional black hole computer that exists at the heart of being. And it's interconnected to all the phenomena that manifest around that central point in life. And all the interconnectedness of things.
It's very helpful. Your book is coming out in paper soon, but is it? Have you published it at all in another form at this point?
Yeah, I have it available. As I sell my books, traditionally they've been 8.5 by 11 with Sherlock bindings,
I've sold them.
It's available in that form. Yeah,
okay.
You bought a copy of it when I was there in California 3 years ago,
okay.
John.
But you modified it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's much more advanced. I've just spent the last 6 to 8 months. I reread The Secret Doctrine and took extensive notes and went through my whole book a final time.
Get it again, but I'm looking at your website now, and do you have a variety? is the revised version, the latest version, also on your website in a spiral bound? Or what I'm saying is you're coming out with a new paperback, right, shortly of that.
Yeah.
Is that going to be revised from what you have already available on the website, or is it just a matter of putting it in paper?
What's up on my website tends to be older versions of my writing. Actually, some of them are 3 and 4 years old. And when I hope over the next while to put all the revised material, because it's much better and clearer and more elaborate.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is, the latest version of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine is not available yet in any form. Is that what you're saying in terms of it's coming out in papers soon?
Yeah, it's available now in the Sherlock binding form.
Okay, so that's what I'm asking. In other words, the new version that's coming out, the difference is just the binding, basically, from what's available now in terms of the binding.
Yeah.
Okay, in other words, if I don't want to wait...
they are available. I'm continuing to sell all my books
They're available, but
I'm trying to get all of them into trade paperback format.
Okay, I got you, but it is available. So I'm going to get the latest one because the one I got in California a couple years ago, it sounds like you've updated a lot, correct?
Yeah, a lot, very significantly.
Okay, yeah, because what you're saying now, what you've been saying really ties a lot of things together. Now, you were talking about the wheels within wheels that Madame Blavatsky was talking about.
Yes.
You mentioned that phrase. You know, did she make a specific connection between that phrase and there's a vision of Ezekiel in the Bible? Where did she connect it to that at all?
I forget if she does or not. I forget.
Because a lot of people, he, Ezekiel, I don't know if you're familiar with that in the Old Testament. He has Ezekiel, the prophet, he has a vision of this wheels within wheels, you know, and some people interpret that as some spaceship or something, but I think it's more likely what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'd say that it's more likely kind of zero-point dynamics and such.
Yeah, because if she uses the phrase wheels within wheels, I can't imagine that she's not thinking about that vision in the Bible. I mean,
I don't recall whether she discusses it at the same time or not. But
I can't, wheels within wheels. I can't think of any other time in literature where that phrase has been used.
Yeah, my chapter on this in the new version of God, Science, and Secret Doctrine, it's titled From 7 Holy Circumgyrating Breaths to Whirlwinds and Fohat's Circular Errands. Mm-hmm. And it then goes into, here's a stanza of Zan. This is... in stanza 3, verse 1, it says, the primordial 7, the first 7 breaths of the dragon of wisdom, produce in their turn from their holy circumgyrating breaths the fiery whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on, and the fiery whirlwind is that's conveyed by Fohat, who is the fiery whirlwind, which impresses the divine thought into matter. So Fohat connects spirit to matter. So the material, the matter, the body, soul, and spirit, and Fohat connects the intelligence above to the material below and runs the errands of the 7 luminous lords. And Fohat is described as running its errands through these 7 invisible points, that the universe is set on these 7 zero-point centers. So we can take universe like as the universe, but we could also take it as meaning an individual self, like ourself, like the sun. Yeah, exactly.
Right. An amazing work you've done here, compiling all this, and I think you're really light years away ahead of physics. Physics is just barely touching this concept of the singularity. And I had sent you an email once about a physicist named Nassim Haramein.
Yeah.
And I think he would benefit greatly by your work because he's just starting to get the mathematics of the singularity and the as it relates to the proton, but doesn't, you know, hasn't put together all these different seven layers and so forth that you're doing. And
I know when I publish a book, I'm going to be sending him a copy, and I
yeah, please
might
do because
yeah.
I think he'd be open to it, but he's just, you know, he's trying to do the rigorous mathematics and just starting, you know, he's trying to convince the mainstream science of the singularity as a major undertaking, you know, of a single point.
Yeah,
and then beyond that, you know, all these other layers and things is really necessary. That's the next step that you're
yeah.
talking about is to go beyond that, because this explains what you're doing, explains spirituality and the soul and cosmic evolution and so forth.
Yeah.
But you know, it's the big picture essentially is what you have here. But traditional.
Yeah,
science,
I know. I have. I thank you for sending me the link, and I pursued it and seen several videos of him, and printed out another article of his on. That I'm going to read. He talks about the sun as having a white hole, black hole center.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is very profound in the secret doctrine. Blavatsky describes the sun behind the sun, like our sun is rooted into the realm beyond that, and it has a zero-point center. So the invisible sun is a kind of zero-point portal within the sun, and it can be seen as a white hole when it expands without, and it as a black hole as it withdraws into the center. So, so in mystical teachings, the sun and the planets are said to have these kind of zero-point centers. And his work, that's what he's come to, is that yes, there's like this kind of zero-point center at the heart of the sun. So. Yeah, his work's very interesting, and you know, now scientists think that our galaxy may have a singularity and black hole center.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what's so amazing in mysticism is that it's saying that these dynamics we study in the universe can also all be applied to ourselves, which all makes it so significant and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He has a conference call once a month. You could get in on that and actually talk to him directly.
That would be neat. I'll have to look that up.
Actually, just go to his website. I mean, I listen every month, and you could get on in there and ask him. You could dialogue with him, and other people would hear about your work, too, because there's a group of people that follow that, and then they have a chat and so forth. So if you call, you could talk to him actually about your work. I mean, he's open to other things. He's not going to put you off because you have another theory. You could talk to him and tell him about your work directly, and tell him you're going to send this and that, and anyway, ask him a question and start contributing, and other people would hear about your work, and it would expand the dialogue. His next one is going to be on August 18th.
I'll try to get that set up. Try to attend that.
6 p.m. Pacific time. But just go to his website, the Resonance Project.
Oh, yeah.
And go to events. Go to events, and you'll see, you know, once a month. It's usually the third Wednesday of the month. And his next one is it's at 3 p.m. Hawaii time, which is 6 p.m. West Coast time. And it usually lasts for about an hour and a half. And you can, you know, register for that on there, and then you can call. And I'm actually going to be seeing him in October in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's doing he's going to be at the non-duality conference.
Oh, yeah, really? Isn't the number of 1 divided by 137 a good non-dual reality?
Yeah, I mean, you could speak at that. You should probably look at that on the website, because they take papers. They close for papers now, but it'd be good for you to present a paper and appear there, next year. It's usually at the same time every year. It sells out. You can go look at it. Just go on the web and look at, I think it's NAN, whatever it is, the non-dual conferences. And you can see, and they'll take call for papers, and you can see what was accepted. I'd love to see you present there next year. It's usually October every year in the Bay Area.
I guess I've been staying undercover a bit and trying to get these two books printed, and then I'm hoping to kind of take a more public profile once I have these two books done.
I hope
that'll be coming up, and I'll look into that. John, I noticed it's coming down to time.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much for calling in. I'm pleased to speak with you.
Okay. I appreciate all the work you do, and just keep it up.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, well, that wraps it up for this July 24th, and I'd like to thank BBS Radio. It's such a pleasure to be able to have 2 hours of uninterrupted time as such as we have there. So in the next weeks, we'll continue on with this discussion of the esoteric teachings of the secret doctrine and the metaphysics and physics of these creation studies. Thanks for joining us today, and peace be with you. Goodbye.